In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Paul Lussier about his book, Last Refuge of Scoundrels. The subtitle is A Revolutionary Novel, and it is indeed an irreverent and revisionist look at the American Revolution. It's gotten a lot of positive attention. It's out fairly recently. The book is published by Warner Books. We'll be talking about it here this morning. And also I'd like to mention that our guest, Paul Lussier, will be in Champaign-Urbana for a book signing at Pages for All Ages this weekend. That'll be Sunday, May 6th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you'll have the opportunity to meet him and hear more from him. A little bit more about him. He majored in critical studies and literature at Yale. He's an ongoing student of the new history and spent quite a bit of time, something like 10 years, researching the book, Last Refuge of Scoundrels, while at the same time being involved as writer and producer for a number of media ventures, among them the award-winning classic Doing Time on Maple Drive, which is a feature about the real story of George and Joy Adamson, the couple featured in the book and now a movie, Born Free. He also has been involved with an event for ABC based on his latest book, which is titled Savage Grace, The Mayflower Crossing, which re-examines the saga of the pilgrims in America. He writes and lectures throughout the country. He is talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we do that, of course, we'd welcome whatever questions you might have. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. You can use the toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call, calls on us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Lussier, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
I can see how, if being someone who is interested in what has been called new history, and perhaps we should define that, it means essentially an approach to history that looks at the efforts, the activities, the contributions of regular folks.
How the other half lived and lives, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that it's not just what did, for example, in reference to the Revolution, it would be a reproach that said it's not just what Ben Franklin did and Tom Jefferson did and George Washington did. It's that acknowledging the fact that if it wasn't for regular people, the folks who carried the muskets and did an awful lot of other things, there wouldn't have been any revolution.
That's very true, and that's very true. And in fact, one of the things that the book attempts to do, and I judging certainly from the success thus far of the book, I think it manages it. Is it tries to not only adopt in the narrating of its story, not only adopt the common man's point of view as antagonistic, although there is a lot of that, to the parade of the founding fathers, but rather tries to capture the synergy, particularly via George Washington, the synergy between the common people and the bailiwick of the aristocratic class, as represented by the founding fathers, that ultimately that resulted in our winning at Yorktown. And in fact, it is that dialectic between the common man and the concerns of the common man, which were absolutely contrasting to what the founding fathers wanted, certainly at the start of the war, that I seek to capture that dialectic via my two characters. You know, this hooker, who is named Deborah Simpson in the book, who is based on real life, a real life character who was a hooker who dressed as a male soldier and fought as Robert Shurtleff and became... she is a composite of Deborah, the soldier, as well as two spies of George Washington's, both of whom were women, and she became, in the book, she becomes one of George Washington's major spies. And then the other character through whose eyes we begin to build this dialectic is John Lawrence, who was, in fact, an aide of George Washington's, a sort of an androgynous man, if you will, who George Washington ultimately dispatched to France in 1780, right before the victory at Yorktown. And he sent this 28-year-old young man to France specifically to replace Benjamin Franklin in his efforts to appeal to the French king to get us aid. And John Lawrence succeeded. He did get in. And Benjamin Franklin wasn't terribly happy about it.
Hmm. You know, I think in one of the things that I read about the book, you I'm hoping I remember this right, you said you thought that in a way you were a little bit disappointed by the reaction of some people to the book who apparently think that your intent was to sully the image, the reputation of the founding fathers, and you seem to be saying, no, that certainly is not what you were about.
No, first of all, I have a complicated answer to that question, but I think, first of all, I think this if any urge to humanize and to tell the truths about the founding fathers that, by the way, they wanted to be told, and I can get to that in a moment, any urge to humanize them can be marginalized and as an attempt to debunk them is quite wrong. First of all, the fact that John Hancock in particular is a hypochondriac, is seen in the book in the early years of the war as a hypochondriac, and the founding fathers were basically all bemoaning John Hancock's arrival at their daily meetings, wondering what would be his ailment of for the day, and John Adams nursing fantasies to be American king at the outset of the war, and James Otis, who is famous for that quote, "A man's right to life is his liberty," certainly a famous quote. Do I dishonor that quote by ultimately revealing that while he was mouthing these words, he was running through the provincial Congress screaming fire just for the heck of it and dropping bricks on pedestrians on the sidewalk as they passed below his window? No, I think I argue that I don't inveigh against their greatness, because what you do see in the book, David, is you watch these men negotiate their way through the minefield of their neuroses, the minefield of their madness. And let's face it, you had to be a little bit mad in order to attempt what we were attempting. There was a whole new worldview that was behind our fight for independence. But anyway, you watch these men negotiate their way through their vested interests to arrive at an almost, in fits and starts, an almost transcendent greatness. And I argue vehemently that to see our founding fathers as men who ultimately triumphed over their imperfections, as opposed to men who popped out of the womb perfect, is very empowering to students, children, adults of all kinds, because then it enables me to, who admittedly is an imperfect being, and we know ourselves to be imperfect, to not go into denial about my own perfections, and say, rather, my goodness, if John Hancock can journey from a man who arranged this famous boycott against British goods in Boston, and while he was arranging this boycott and enforcing this boycott to the tune of dispatching his own sons of liberty to tar and feather common people who violated it, he himself, in the midst of all this, is violating his own boycott by sending 14-year-old kids down to New Jersey to get little bits of smoked salmon that he had smuggled in by rowboat because he swore he couldn't live without the stuff, okay? To see him move from a man who would violate his own boycott because smoked salmon meant so much to him, and he really had only an economic interest in this boycott because the tea that was being, the British tea boycotted, was more expensive than his own tea was, and therefore prohibitively expensive, and his own tea would be purchased instead, but that's a whole other story. But the point is to see him journey through this whole minefield of vested interests to be the man who writes and signs the Declaration of Independence with that now famous signature under the threat of hanging. David, it's an amazing journey.
Mm-hmm. Let me just real quick reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Paul Lussier. His book is The Last Refuge. It is, no, the, I'll better be correct with the title, is Last Refuge of Scoundrels,
correct,
a revolutionary novel. It's published by Warner Books. And we should give a nod to, and I think actually I was certainly familiar with this quote that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. We should give credit, and I guess I wasn't even aware, in fact, that it was Samuel Johnson who said that, Dr.
Correct.
Johnson who said that.
That's right.
And a quote, of course, that has been often repeated since. And questions, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think something that you really feature as a theme in the book, and something that we don't often talk here about in this country is class and class conflict,
right.
And that here that there perhaps was as much of a gulf between Americans, even if they didn't call themselves that, between them and Britain, there was also a gulf between the average folks
and the
aristocratic ones, who definitely had different sorts of agendas. And this is something, a theme that you deal with very directly, and something that we don't probably think very much about. We like to think that there is no such thing as class in this
country. Well, that's absolutely true. And it is when you go back, as I did, over a 10-year period to the diaries of common folk that you learn and that you are reminded, first of all, that we were all British. And I know that's a platitude, but it's important to remind the audience we were all British. The poor man on the street who was oppressed, for example, by John Hancock cornering the market on flour, making bread almost impossible to procure for the average man, the difference between a John Hancock doing that and a British royalist doing that was absolutely no difference. All right? There was no question about it that in 1765 Boston, ordinary folk are not writing in their gazettes and their almanacs, in their broadsides, David, about the stamp tax. Okay, the stamp tax was the bailiwick of the attorney class. The stamp tax was the concern of the attorney class. Instead, the riots prior to the stamp tax riots, and I'll get to the stamp tax riots if you want me to. The riots prior to the stamp tax riots were multitudinous in concern and purpose. But to mention two or three, one, women, okay, rioting in the streets for a greater voice in their male household. Okay, this is 1765 Boston, I hasten to add. You know, they're the farmers protesting because now what had happened was that pastures where their cows once grazed freely were being fenced, and farmers were being charged a fee for their cows to graze on that pasture, fees which they could not pay, causing indebtedness, causing imprisonment, and there were rebellions and riots and protests in Boston springing those farmers from jail who had incurred indebtedness as a result of trying to get their cows to graze so that they could live off the milk. Thirdly, and not lastly, but lastly for the sake of this conversation, there were even riots in the street protesting a custom that had been inherited from England, whereby a poor man, if a poor man sees a richer man approaching him on what passed for a sidewalk in 18th century Boston, he would have to step aside into the sewage sludge that passed in rivulets along the sidewalk to let the richer man pass. And to give him passage. These were terrific concerns of the everyday man who had come to Boston under various circumstances, many of them indentured servants, but they had all one thing in common. They thought they were going to get a new lease on life. And what they were getting was that the hierarchical structure was mimicking everything that they thought they had left behind in England. And they didn't like it at all. And the famous riots under the Liberty Tree were just that. Dionysian bonfire dances around the Liberty Tree, screaming, squawking, clamoring, okay, for greater freedom, clamoring for a kind of, for lack of a better word, a kind of utopic a realization. And what would happen was that Samuel Adams actually walked around Boston with a map that he had little pins in this map, and he would determine Samuel Adams and John Hancock would determine where these riots were going to be, and they would attend these riots, okay? And John Hancock would cater these riots. And someone said the other day, you mean he actually said cater? Yes. By cater, I mean cater. I mean he would bring ale and wine and treats and all of these things that people otherwise could ill afford. And there's actual quotes in the book where you see them working the crowd, promising the crowd that if only they'll get behind Samuel Adams' drive to see the stamp tax removed, that all of their ails would be cured. And Samuel Adams was even as preposterous to suggest that smallpox would be vanquished if the people would only get behind the stamp tax. And they would erect little shows. They would erect little shows, and they would ask people to play actors. One would be the stamp tax master. The other would be the person about to be taxed. And the other, and the person would strip, and their little, and their buttocks would be stamped, or their forehead would be stamped, and they'd get drunk and hang from trees. I mean, this is all in the book. It's a fantastic scene, if I say so myself. But the point is, David, that most of these people who were then corralled over to the stamp tax master's house and encouraged to throw bricks in the stamp tax master's window had no awareness of who even Andrew Oliver, the stamp master who lived in that house, was. This was a rich man's mansion, and they were only too happy to destroy it, and they were only too happy to have a good night of revelry and fun. But what happens? And through our protagonist, John Lawrence, who sees this event and then reads what Samuel Adams is writing about it in the very next day in the Boston Gazette, Samuel Adams writes, "This is the result of that." Writes about the riot. "This is the result of taxation without representation. Britain, you must watch your step because the people are up in arms." Mm. And so, what do? We go back to these approved sources when we write about our own revolution. We go back to what Samuel Adams wrote about the event. We don't go back to what common people shared and discussed and were enchanted by in the event. And in that trick, okay, not conscious on anyone's part, but in that trick of rhetoric, you lose the suggestion of class, you lose the spirit, the soul, the drive, the quest of the everyday man. Mm.
And just not to put too fine a point on this, but for those people who are listening to your stories and thinking to themselves, this is not the version that they heard, you're not making this up.
Oh, no. I'll tell you. In fact, would like me to speak to that?
Sure.
I have a sort of a longish answer to that too. I hope that's okay.
Oh, that's okay.
When I was a kid, I went to Mount Vernon and I asked for, as many people do, the sight of evidence of the felled cherry tree. And I remember the tour guide, it was an epiphanic moment for me because the tour guide said that story is not true. I immediately began to wonder, well, if this story isn't true, why am I being told it? And why is the ideology attendant to that story, i.e. a depiction of George Washington as someone who will never tell a lie, why is that ubiquitous? I was one of those 13-year-old nerds who picked up Washington's diaries and spent all of my youth reading all 2,000 pages, okay? I went to Yale to be a historian by trade, to be a scholar by trade. This is what I wanted. And when I read those diaries, I saw a completely different man emerge. I saw a tender human being. I saw a witty human being. I saw a George Washington who writes, as I do at the beginning of the book, "Oh, how I wish I'd never seen the Continental Army. I wish I had moved to the country and retired in a wigwam." You know, I saw George Washington who, when he is being hallowed at his own inauguration, and hallowed, I mean hallowed, a mechanical wreath being lowered on his head from a makeshift Arch of Triumph, chorus of angels surrounding him in white flowing robes, singing hallelujah and throwing flowers on his path. What is George Washington's response to that? He writes to Martha, "Oh, dear, I feel like a culprit going to my own beheading." Okay? I saw this tremendous gap between what was being spun about George Washington, what was being said, and what I felt intuitively, well, not only felt intuitively what he wanted, would want to have said about him, but what he was in these pages. And I couldn't get over the gap. I said, from whence does this come? Do we not then, even if you believe in this mythology that George Washington is a man who would never want to tell a lie, don't we dishonor him then by telling lies about him? Anyway, I went to Yale. I became a student of history, and it was at Yale. This was back in 1980, and it was at Yale that I finally began to see historical documentation validating my own perceptions of the man, my own intuitions of the man. Right? I thought, oh, this is interesting. And the sources were not the traditional sources. The revisionist movement—a word I don't like, by the way—because I think it marginalizes an attempt to simply make history more broad and more inclusive and get closer to an approximation of the truth. But anyway, I read all these things, and I was delighted. I had decided I was going to get my doctorate in history, be a historian. I was going to get the word out. This was going to be my thing. Well, I spent my summers returning to Mount Vernon, and this movement was already about 15 years old by the time I came to it. And what did I see? I saw grown-ups, now 40-year-olds, still asking for sight of the felled cherry tree, still being told that it's not true. All right. And furthermore, if you were to ask most of those adults if it's true, most adults will say, yeah, it's not true. But guess what? The story has such a stranglehold on the popular imagination that it doesn't stop people from looking. And what I saw there then and there, had a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a vision, it's a big word, but a little bit of an insight that, oh, this is the road we're going down. All of these facts that are being uncovered in academia are going to sit flat in the university, and they're not going to scale academic walls, and scholars are going to be writing for other scholars, and this myth is too powerful, it's not going to make inroads. And I resolved then that my vocation was not to be a historian, my vocation was to be a storyteller. And I spent the next 10 years while pursuing a career in Hollywood as my day job, and as you point out, garnering a tremendous amount of success, some of which was distracting for me in this vocation. I spent all of my off time keeping up entirely with the academic community and intending to write this book and researching this book. And so the discoveries kept coming. From Sally Hemings on through, the discoveries kept coming, revealing, you know, what more and more and more of what really went on. And I... To sum up my very long story, I then decided that I was going to write a book that would compete head-on. The reason why the facts stay in the university is because they are just that. They are facts. And facts do not change minds. Stories do. The reason the cherry tree mythology is so pervasive is not only because it's a good story. Is it because it speaks to very specific yearnings, very specific longings, and very specific anxieties that facts can't touch? So I decided that my job, my vocation, was to take these facts and spin them into one hell of a yarn that's as entertaining as I could possibly be, that is funny, that is suspenseful, that's a page-turner, that's written in a contemporary idiom, not an 18th-century idiom, but a story that can reach out and find a place in people's souls the way the cherry tree myth did. And, you know, to finish up, the cherry tree mythology in and of itself is on its last legs. People that advocate for it can advocate for it all they want, but they don't read books on the American Revolution, and furthermore, they don't even go to movies about the American Revolution. Even Mel Gibson can't save the Patriot, and that's why the American Revolution is virtually taboo as a source of it, as entertainment in Hollywood or anywhere else, because people say people are bored by the story. Well, it's because our cultural mythology, the consensus behind it, has broken down. We know too much. We know George Washington could not have been this hollow, statuesque figure, but we literally don't have the story. We don't have a new story to replace it with. So my intention was to write a new story that would contribute to that gap, that we walk out of Patriot, we think, okay, it feels hollow, I don't get it, it doesn't resonate with me, but we don't have a language, we've got nothing else. So I set out to be that something else.
Well, and for people who are here listening here, if that sounds good to you, if that's the book you want to read, then you should look for the book we've talked about here. We're talking about, the title is Last Refuge of Scoundrels, a Revolutionary Novel. The author, our guest, Paul Lussier, is published by Warner Books. And I also want to mention again, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, he will be doing a book signing and talk about Last Refuge of Scoundrels at Pages for All Ages Bookstore this weekend. That'll be on Sunday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you're interested in meeting him, hearing more from him, you just head on over to Pages. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Bloomington. Let's talk with them. Our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I recently heard on this program that George Washington was an extremely rich man who owned 200 slaves. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. Mm-hmm. Now, and for people who say, well, that was the thing to do, that he can be forgiven for not having more awareness on that subject, this is not true. George, there were many, many Quakers writing about the time, and there was a profoundly aggressive abolitionist movement even at the time. But the economic vested interests, of course, were such that George Washington could not afford could not practically afford to release his slaves to freedom. Mount Vernon would have collapsed. Now, what's interesting about George Washington, sir, is that George Washington in many ways does degree the moniker father of our country, because even though he did not go so far as to free his slaves, although I must tell you, when he died, he gave Martha permission to free all of his slaves, and she did free his slaves, but she didn't free her own. But that's a whole other digression. But the point is, George Washington betrays terrific pain and much conflict over the issue of being a slaveholder. Even in the course of the American Revolution, sir, this protagonist in my book, John Lawrence, makes an attempt. He's from the South, and he approaches George Washington in the waning days of the war about putting together a black battalion that he would lead, that would largely consist, at least at the outset, of his own, John Lawrence's own, freed slaves, because John Lawrence himself was the scion of a very rich Charleston planter and a slaveholder. And George Washington agreed, yes, this is a good thing. Yes, we should do this. Go ahead, set up your black battalion. But what happened, sir, was that Congress quashed it miserably. Okay? And George Washington was defeated by that. Now, yes, one could say George Washington never fought them on it and took it as his due and took it on the chin. Yes, indeed, one could argue that. But the fact is, George Washington did try.
He also kept his slaves.
He kept his slaves, yes. And he was a man who really ultimately could not cross over to that other side of greater. He couldn't commit to the awareness that he had. I credit him with some awareness, but no, you're absolutely right. He could not and did not commit to that awareness. He left it to Martha to free his slaves. And it's interesting that she freed his slaves but not her own. I find that's interesting.
Have we answered your question? I guess we did. And other people, if you have questions, you're welcome to call 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think it's interesting that, perhaps it's explained by this longstanding interest that you talked about in Washington, of the founders that appear in the book, he certainly comes off as one of the most interesting, admirable, particularly because of the kind of personal transformation that seems to have gone on in him, how it is he changed from that first day when he hauled out his uniform from the French and Indian War, stuffed himself into it, and appeared before the Continental Congress, offering himself as candidate to be general of the army that didn't exist. There's a big change in this man and how he thought about what this was all about from that point to the point at which the war is brought to a successful conclusion, and then he goes on to be the first president.
I'm delighted, and it's very intuitive of you, and I commend you for picking that up, because I think his transformation is profound and beautiful. You know, I think, George, you're absolutely right. The man who competed, and so entertainingly and humorously for that post of commander-in-chief, having no understanding of what the army, the kind of rabble that the army up in Cambridge consisted of, the kind of people that he, but frankly, the kind of people that would step off the sidewalk into the sewage sludge to let him pass, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the people that he was going to lead. This was an military opportunity for him. He gets to Cambridge and they deliver him in a lacquered coach and on a white steed, and these Lexington and Concord farmers who have surrounded Boston, in speaking in popular parlance, are basically saying, what's the deal? Who is this guy? This man who's sort of just come over to take over the army, and they look at each other and they say, what army? We're a bunch of farmers in breeches who have won at Bunker. We've done fine at Bunker Hill. We've done fine at Lexington and Concord. We don't need a general. And what happens is George Washington, true to his form, David, spends his first few days writing about what a nasty, brutish lot these Massachusetts Yanks are, and furthermore obsesses on what their uniforms are. He says, well, this isn't an army. We have to have uniforms. He starts as a man who ultimately just wanted to run an army that he thought could impress England. And ultimately, he'd been so maltreated by the Brits in the French and Indian War that ultimately he just wanted a beautiful army and be on a beautiful steed so he could sort of say, there you go, you never should have ignored me in the first place. But ultimately what happens is that the need to win the war and to live cheek by jowl, elbow to elbow with men he'd rather have not had anything to do with completely changes him.
And it also, I think what you hint at there, and what you certainly write about in the book, is the concerns that members of the Congress had at the time that this quote unquote revolution, this rabble army,
right,
that it had some notable successes against the British and was getting everybody all whipped up into this fervor, was something that they, the Congress, were concerned this was something that was out of their control, and they wanted it to be under their control, and that
That's exactly right.
This business of sending Washington to whip these people into shape and making an army was a way of the Congress getting control over these people.
Well, for example, I mean, this to them was just to most of them, John Adams among them, this was just a big, huge protest movement and a lot of hoopla, you know, and Gage should never have been enticed out to Lexington and Concord, and this was a Yankee problem, and this was a farmer's problem. The congressmen of their day saw the legacy of Bacon's Rebellion, which was a farmer's rebellion much earlier on, but they saw the legacy and the protest movement, scurrilous farmers protesting up and down the coast, the regulars in North Carolina, Bacon's Rebellion, etc. They had become legion as people who ultimately wanted to bring down the aristocratic class, who were closing courts because the judges were treating the poor farmers unfairly, who were throwing people who couldn't pay debts, debts incurred, into prison. They were the aristocratic class, which is what the delegates all came from, were very concerned that this, in effect, was a people's revolution. And when they sent George Washington, they said, okay, we've got our gripes with England, but we are going to send an army, we're going to send a commander, but guess what? We're not going to send them guns. And they sent, I mean, it's very funny in the book, but they sent George Washington to organize this army and to put them all in nice, sharp uniforms and to discipline them before even they approved the sale of any guns, okay? Because they did not want to arm the average man on the street. And, you know, in that musical, 1776, they make fun. They have a little bit of fun with George Washington's constant pleas. Please give us guns. Please give us ammunition. Please finance, you know, this army that you've set up. And the founding fathers are, you know, are ignoring it. What's interesting when you look at, when you deconstruct something even like 1776, David, you look at 1776, and it's interesting that Washington's pleas for help are a source of humor that make George Washington neurotic and sort of boring and sort of monotonous. And what is not a source of humor, okay, and what is not emphasized for the comedy of it is the founding fathers' ignoring of those pleas. You see the flip?
It's also interesting to me that this flies in the face of one of the articles of faith about early America, and that was there was a gun in every home.
Right. No way.
Which apparently was not the case.
No. Well, the point is there were lots of guns around, but they were simply muskets. They weren't real arms, the kind that ultimately would be required to fight the war. They were fowling pieces primarily, and they were just miserable weapons, really.
Well, we have some other folks to talk
with.
Let's get back here. We'll talk next with someone in southeastern Illinois on line number 4. Hello.
I had another question that came up as you were talking, and then I'll ask my first question. But these farmers were not then a regular militia. They were simply farmers with their own guns who came together on an ad hoc occasion for an ad hoc purpose.
You better believe it, but there were some militia as well.
Yeah, but I mean the main thing, I mean that it was the citizen with his own guns that was the basis of the primary rebellious group.
Correct, and citizens even without guns. It was mostly when crowds flocked to Lexington and Concord, sir, most of the alarm bell rang, and most of them, it was sort of like no one really intended to shoot at the British, as sort of the story goes, and it's true. There was really an attempt. Some people showed up. It was a party, really. Some people showed up expecting a parade, and they were on rooftops, and they were hanging out of windows, and there were men selling ale on the street, because this was really an entertainment. Yes, the militia had prepared for the day that the British may or may not come. And yes, there was rumors that one day the British, in fact, would come, and there were people trying to get the British to come to Lexington and Concord, because and I detail this in the book, specifically to Lexington and Concord, to where they wanted to attract the British, because they felt they could beat them back in that spot. But You're absolutely right. It was not a trained army. It was mostly not a trained militia. But in additionally to that, most people were not really rousing themselves to war at Lexington and Concord. It just sort of worked out that way.
Could you say then that it was somewhat analogous to the Russians who stood just as people against the tanks when they were trying to overthrow, who was it, Gorbachev?
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I would say it's extremely, extremely similar scaling back that wall. I mean, I think, and this is what David was referring to, which I was very happy he picked up, there was no question about it that when these farmers flocked to Lexington and Concord, the issue that loomed in their minds was not the philosophical issue of independence with a capital I from England, okay? What Gage and all of his redcoats represented to these people was a reinforcing, a furthering of the status quo, okay? Men with red coats shutting ordinary sailors out of jobs in Boston, men with red coats being beheaded in their homes and people not being given any choice if a red coat was to be housed in their homes or not. They were not giving any choice whatsoever. And men coming from the British Empire that represented a furthering of the oppression of the ordinary man.
Could I ask one question before I get the hook here? There are others waiting. Have you been or are you scheduled to be on C-SPAN's Book TV?
I am scheduled to be on C-SPAN's Book TV sometime at the end of May. I was just at the White House. I was invited at the White House, actually, a couple of days ago as well to speak about my book. And I'm on TV virtually. The media blitz is sort of pervasive. And I'll even be on the History Channel, too, sir, on July 4th. There's a whole special on my book as well.
I don't get it. I do get Book TV. I do get C-SPAN.
So. Great.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This will be Champagne in line two. Hello.
Hello, Morton. A couple of questions. One, are you familiar with the novelist playwright Ishmael Reed, who's done some, satirical and somewhat surrealistic historical novels?
No, I'm not familiar with it. Ishmael Reed, R-E-E-D?
E-E-D, yeah. Ishmael Reed, he's a African-American author. You'd probably especially like A Flight to Canada, which is a Civil War story told from the viewpoint of a slave. But also, I mean, they're using telephones and having meetings between Lincoln and other people are talking on the telephone with, you know, leaders in the wealthy southern owners and things like that. But you might want to check out some of his
sure.
and how he uses history and sort of, you know, creating new history
paradigms?
Or myths or, you know, stories.
Right.
Also, if, you know, you're really interested in popularizing these stories, then are you looking into, getting this turned into a movie or maybe even a
already in process. Your intuitions are right on target. The target. The movie will be out, probably in about 11 to 12 months. Warner Brothers is directing it. Warner Brothers is producing it. It'll be a feature film in screens everywhere in the very near future. So your intuitions are right on target. I'm not quite as anachronistic as giving people – I'm not anachronistic, really, and David has read and he can vouch for it, as cell phones, whatever, because I did want – ultimately, like I say, I spent so many years researching this, and I felt, frankly, that I had something very powerful to support and a point of view to advocate for, and I didn't want to undermine my credibility by making anything up. And this sort of goes back to your question, too, David, you know, is it true?
Hmm.
You better believe it's true. You can't attempt to do what I'm doing and to undermine your credibility by making things up. The weirder the instances instances in the book, the more quizzical it is, the more queer it is, the truer it is.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
So is there actually a director for the project, for the film?
Well, Although I'm writing this screenplay, If They Keep Me, we'll ultimately see, because they're already wanting to push this love story between John and Deborah, which is, in the book, as you know, is sensual but platonic, turning it into something that is more traditional than that relationship could ever be. But the rumor is that Ben Stiller is going to direct it.
Ben Stiller, that's...
Yeah, it's the right sensibility, though, don't
interesting.
You think?
Yes, actually, I could see that.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how this develops. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left. Our guest is novelist Paul Lussier. His book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled The Last Refuge of Scoundrels. It's published by Warner Books, and it is out now in bookstore. We have a couple of other people. We have somebody here on a cell phone, so I want to get to them on line 4. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if you could comment about Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States.
And yes, I certainly can, sir. And I don't know if you guys have seen any of the ads. David, you certainly have. But Howard Zinn as well has picked up my book and is basically stumping the country, saying that he's never read a better historical novel in his life. I had never met, everyone assumes that I must have known Howard Zinn. And by the way, also Studs Terkel and Robert Coles and Jonathan Kozel are also doing the same. I have not met any of these men, and I had not met any of these men, and even now have only met and laid eyes on Howard Zinn, where we were at a book event together in Boston where he spoke in advocacy of my book. I credit, if Howard Zinn did not exist, this book would not exist. He was among the first brave voices to ultimately try to capture and vindicate the common man in history, and to try to redefine history as something that included more than a parade of the founding fathers.
Yeah. So he's a very important figure in this movement that some people call New History or People's History,
right. And
has authored a number of books. So if folks are interested in sampling this kind of approach, they can definitely go to the bookstore, go to the library. You should find his books.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
All right. Let's try another here. Bloomington, Indiana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Lussier.
Yes.
You have written a novel with some little-known facts. There are some more little-known facts that would be wonderful to be used if you consider another novel, little-known facts that demonstrate how such flawed men as our founding fathers could have founded such a great, great country. And some of these little-known facts, you know, most people think that our founding fathers were mostly atheists, agnostics, and skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one little-known fact. Of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, 27 of those signers had Bible seminary degrees. And that's pretty good for a bunch of atheists, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I first of all, I don't think, though, sir, that most people really think that most of the founding fathers were atheists and secularists. I do think, sir, there is debate, and there is absolute debate as to how religious George Washington was or wasn't.
Well,
and having spent all of those years reading every single – I'm probably the only person on earth who's read every single word George Washington has ever written. I can tell you
– you have read his prayers.
Mm-hmm.
You have read his prayers.
He doesn't have prayers. George Washington did not.
You haven't read everything he wrote.
George Washington did not pray. He did not pray in the way that you and I call prayer. George Washington was a Mason, and George Washington was transcendental, and George Washington did not subscribe to a particular Christian or not belief. He was not that. He practiced.
He was an Episcopalian, what you would now call an Anglican.
Right, right.
And he was the president of our Constitutional Convention.
Right.
And he said that religion affords government its surest support. As, by the way, so did James Madison, who was the chief architect of our Constitution, and who, by the way, was one of those who had a seminary degree.
Well, this is a longer discussion, but I would argue that George Washington's definition of religion, though, was much broader than whether it was Anglican or not. I would argue that George Washington's experience with the common people that he grew to have opened him up to a religious understanding that went beyond the traditional paradigms of its day or even today.
Have you read many of Jefferson's? Do you know much about Jefferson? You know, Jefferson was supposed to be one of the least religious of the signers of our Declaration of Independence, but today he would be considered a Christian fanatic, because in 1774 in the Virginia legislature, Thomas Jefferson introduced a resolution for a day of fasting and prayer. He endorsed the use of the local courthouse for Christian religious services. And then, as president, Right. He wrote the first plan of education for Washington, D.C., and in that education plan, he made the Bible and Watts Hymnal the main textbooks. That was Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, I don't deny that, sir. But he was also having affairs with his slaves, and so that does. And if you're to argue, if your vision of Thomas Jefferson as a good Christian man who was expert in his understanding of the Bible, if your understanding it forcibly excludes other facts about Thomas Jefferson, which also compromise him in that religious belief, then I don't agree with you.
I agree that he was the least religious. He was one of the least religious, and yet these were his sentiments that I've just specified. And probably another of the least religious was Benjamin Franklin. And
right.
He did some bad things, too.
Right.
But at the Constitutional Convention, when the Constitutional Convention was about to break up in disorder and conflict, Benjamin Franklin called the Constitutional Convention to prayer. He made a resolution that they had prayer. And so they dismissed the Constitutional Convention, and they had about 3 days of prayer and fasting. Right. If they had not had those 3 days of prayer and fasting, we probably wouldn't have had a Constitution, because they were ready to break up in disorder. And when they came back from that prayer and fasting, they gave us our Constitution.
Well,
wouldn't that be a story?
I think we're almost at the point where we have to finish up. I don't know. You want to make any other comment on that?
No, I think I can't speak to the Constitutional Convention, but I do. I definitely take issue with any group trying to claim the founding fathers, you know, as uniquely religious or as uniquely secular or as uniquely pro-black or anti-black or whatever it may be. The fact of the matter is, the founding fathers are a mixed bag. And some may have been religious, and some may have been irreligious, and some, in fact, were atheists, and some were secular. And in that diverse, eclectic parade of the founding fathers, you will find the diverse, eclectic tapestry of America equally represented.
Well, I wish we could continue. I'm sure there's more we could find to talk about, but we've used our time.
Oh my goodness, it went by race by.
It always does. But for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're fortunate enough that this weekend our guest, Paul Lussier, will be here. He'll be at Pages for All Ages for a talk and signing on Sunday afternoon at 2. This is May 6th, Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, 2 p.m. on Sunday, and you'll have the opportunity to meet him. And, of course, anybody, if you go down to your local bookstore, you can find the book Last Refuge of Scoundrels, published by Warner. Mr. Lussier, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, you were a delight. You can also get it on Amazon. And since many people have called in, how do you spell his name? If I might offer your listeners, it's L-U-S-S-I-E-R.
Paul. Very good. We appreciate the time.
Thank you, David.